Chapter 2. Because everybody else asks him, and Mr. Ranville of the Foreign Office, who might give some news of the Spanish squabble, and Botherby, who has suddenly sprung up into note, because he is intimate with the French Revolution, and visits Ledru Rollin and Lamartine. And these, with a couple more who are Amos de la Mason, made up the 20, whom Mrs. Timmons thought she might safely invite to her little dinner. But the deuce of it was, that when the answers to the invitations came back, everybody accepted. Here was a pretty quandary. How they were to get 20 into their dining room was a calculation which poor Timmons could not solve at all, and he paced up and down the little room in dismay. "Pooh," said Rosa with a laugh. "Our sister Blanche looked very well in one of my dresses last year, and you know how stout she is. We will find some means to accommodate them all, depend upon it." Mrs. John Rowdy's note to dear Rosa, accepting the latter's invitation, was a very gracious and kind one, and Mrs. Fitz showed it to her husband when he came back from chambers. But there was another note which had arrived for him by this time from Mr. Rowdy, or rather from the firm, and to the effect that Mr. F. Timmons had overdrawn his account 28L. 18s. 60, and was requested to pay that sum to his obedient servants, Stumpy, Rowdy, and Company, .. and Timmons did not like to tell his wife that the contending parties in the Low Foyle and Low Corrib Railroad had come to a settlement, and that the 15 guineas a day had consequently determined. "Have had 7 days of it, though," he thought, "and that will be enough to pay for the desk, the dinner, and the glasses, and make all right with Stumpy and Rowdy." 3. The cards for dinner having been issued, it became the duty of Mrs. Timmons to make further arrangements respecting the invitations to the tea party which was to follow the more substantial meal. These arrangements are difficult, as any lady knows who is in the habit of entertaining her friends. There are people who are offended if you ask them to tea, whilst others have been asked to dinner. People who are offended if you ask them to tea at all, and cry out furiously, "Good heavens! Jane, my love, why do these Timmonses suppose that I am to leave my dinner table to attend their soiree?" The dear reader may fill up the to any strength, according to his liking, or, upon my word, "William, my dear, it is too much to ask us to pay 12 shillings for a brougham, and to spend I don't know how much in gloves, just to make our curtsies in Mrs. Timmons' little drawing room." Mrs. Moser made the latter remark about the Timmons affair, while the former was uttered by Mr. Grumpley, barrister at law, to his lady, in Gloucester Plus. "That there are people who are offended if you don't ask them at all is a point which I suppose nobody will question. Timmons' earliest friend in life was Simmons, whose wife and family have taken a cottage at Mortlock for the season. We can't ask them to come out of the country," Rosa said to her Fitzroy between ourselves. She was delighted that Mrs. Simmons was out of the way, and was as jealous of her as every well-regulated woman should be of her husband's female friends. "He can't ask them to come so far for the evening." "Why, no, certainly," said Fitzroy, who has himself no very great opinion of a tea party, and so the Simmonses were cut out of the list. And what was the consequence? The consequence was that Simmons and Timmons cut when they met at Westminster, that Mrs. Simmons sent back all the books which S.E. had borrowed from Rosa, with a withering note of thanks, that Rosa goes about saying that Mrs. Simmons squints, that Mrs. S., on her side, declares that Rosa is crooked, and behaved shamefully to Captain Hicks in marrying Fitzroy over him, though she was forced to do it by her mother, and prefers the captain to her husband to this day. If, in a word, these two men could be made to fight, I believe their wives would not be displeased. And the reason of all this misery, rage, and dissension, lies in a poor little twopenny dinner party in Lilliput Street. Well, the guests, both for before and after meat, having been asked, old Mrs. Gashley, Rosa's mother, and, by consequence, F. Fitzroy's dear mother-in-law, though I promise you that here is particularly sarcastic. Mrs. Gashley, of course, was sent for, and came with Miss Eliza Gashley, who plays on the guitar, and Emily, who limps a little, but plays sweetly on the concertina. They live close by, trust them for that. Your mother-in-law is always within hearing. Thank our stars for the attention of the dear women. The Gashleys, I say, live close by, and came early on the morning after Rosa's notes had been issued for the dinner. When Fitzroy, who was in his little study, which opens into his little dining room, one of those absurd little rooms which ought to be called a gentleman's pantry, and is scarcely bigger than a shower bath, or a state cabin in a ship, when Fitzroy heard his mother-in-law's knock, and her well-known scuffling and chattering in the passage in which she squeezed up young Buttons, the page, while she put questions to him regarding baby, and the cook's health, and whether as he had taken, what Mrs. Gashley had sent overnight, and the housemaid's health, and whether Mr. Timmons had gone to chambers or not, and when, after this preliminary chatter, Buttons flung open the door, announcing Mrs. Gashley and the young ladies, Fitzroy laid down his Times newspaper with an expression that had best not be printed here, and took his hat and walked away. Mrs. Gashley has never liked him since he left off calling her mama and kissing her. But he said he could not stand it any longer, he was hanged if he would. So he went away to chambers, leaving the field clear to Rosa, mama, and the two dear girls. Or to one of them, rather. For before leaving the house, he thought he would have a look at little Fitzroy upstairs in the nursery, and he found the child in the hands of his maternal Aunt Eliza, who was holding him, and pinching him, as if he had been her guitar, I suppose, so that the little fellow bawled pitifully, and his father finally quitted the premises. No sooner was he gone, although the party was still a fortnight off, than the women pounced upon his little study, and began to put it in order. Some of his papers they pushed up over the bookcase, some they put behind the encyclopedia. Some they crammed into the drawers, where Mrs. Gashley found three cigars, which she pocketed, and some letters, over which she cast her eye, and by Fitz's return they had the room as neat as possible, and the best glass and dessert service mustered on the study table. It was a very neat and handsome service, as you may be sure Mrs. Gashley thought, whose rich uncle had purchased it for the young couple, at Spode and Copeland's. But it was only for 12 persons. It was agreed that it would be, in all respects, cheaper and better to purchase a dozen more dessert plates. And with Y silver basket in the center, Mrs. G said, she is always bragging about that confounded bread basket. We need not have any extra china dishes, and the table will look very pretty. On making a roll call of the glass, it was calculated that at least a dozen or so tumblers, 4 or 5 dozen wines, 8 water bottles, and a proper quantity of ice plates were requisite, and that, as they would always be useful, it would be best to purchase the articles immediately. Fitz tumbled over the basket containing them, which stood in the hall as he came in from chambers, and over the boy who had brought them, and the little bill. The women had had a long debate, and something like a quarrel, it must be owned, over the bill of fare. Mrs. Gashley, who had lived a great part of her life in Devonshire, and kept house in great state there, was famous for making some dishes, without which, she thought, no dinner could be perfect. When she proposed her mock turtle, and stewed pigeons, and gooseberry cream, Rosa turned up her nose, a pretty little nose it was, by the way, and with a natural turn in that direction. "Mock turtle in June, Mama," said she. "It was good enough for your grandfather, Rosa," the mama replied. "It was good enough for the Lord High Admiral, when he was at Plymouth. It was good enough for the first men in the county, and relished by Lord Fortescue and Lord Rolls. Sir Lawrence Porker ate twice of it after Exeter races, and I think it might be good enough for—" "I will not have it, Mama," said Rosa, with a stamp of her foot, and Mrs. Gashley knew what resolution there was in that. Once, when S. he had tried to physic the baby, there had been a similar fight between them. So Mrs. Gashley made out a cart, in which the soup was left with a dash a melancholy vacuum, and in which the pigeons were certainly thrust in among the entrees. But Rosa determined they never should make an entree at all into her dinner party, but that she would have the dinner her own way. When Fitz returned, then, and after he had paid the little bill of 6L. 14s. 60 for the glass, Rosa flew to him with her sweetest smiles, and the baby in her arms. And after as he had made him remark, how the child grew every day more and more like him, and after as he had treated him to a number of compliments and caresses, which it were positively fulsome to exhibit in public, and after as he had soothed him into good humor by her artless tenderness, she began to speak to him about some little points which as he had at heart. She pointed out with a sigh, how shabby the old curtains looked since the dear new glasses which her darling Fitz had given her had been put up in the drawing room. Muslin curtains cost nothing, and she must and would have them. The muslin curtains were accorded. She and Fitz went and bought them at Shoolbred's, when you may be sure she treated herself likewise to a neat, sweet, pretty half-mourning, for the court, you know, is in mourning, a neat, sweet barouche, or calamanco, or bombazin, or Tiffany, or some such thing. But Madame Camille, of Regent Street, made it up, and Rosa looked like an angel in it on the night of her little dinner. And, my sweet, she continued, after the curtains had been accorded, Mama and I have been talking about the dinner. She wants to make it very expensive, which I cannot allow. I have been thinking of a delightful and economical plan, and you, my sweetest Fitz, must put it into execution. I have cooked a mutton chop when I was in chambers, Fitz said with a laugh. Am I to put on a cap and an apron? No. But you are to go to the Megatherium Club where, you wretch, you are always going without my leave, and you are to beg Monsieur Mirabolant, your famous cook, to send you one of his best aides de camp, as I know he will, and with his aid we can dress the dinner, and the confectionery at home for almost nothing, and we can show those purse-proud Topham Sawyers and Rowdies, that the humble cottage can furnish forth an elegant entertainment as well as the gilded halls of wealth. Fitz agreed to speak to Monsieur Mirabolant. If Rosa had had a fancy for the cook of the Prime Minister, I believe the deluded creature of a husband would have asked Lord John for the loan of him. IV. Fitzroy Timmons, whose taste for wine is remarkable for so young a man, is a member of the committee of the Egotherium Club, and the great Mirabolant, good-natured as all great men are, was only too happy to oblige him. A young friend and protege of his, of considerable merit, M. Cavalcator, happened to be disengaged through the lamented death of Lord Hauncher, with whom young Cavalcator had made his debut as an artist. He had nothing to refuse to his master, Mirabolant, and would impress himself to be useful to a gourmet so distinguished as Monsieur Timmons. Fitz went away as pleased as Punch with this encomium of the great Mirabolant, and was one of those who voted against the decreasing of Mirabolant's salary when the measure was proposed by Mr. Perrings, Colonel Close, and the Screw party in the committee of the club. Faithful to the promise of his great master, the youthful Cavalcator called in Lilliput Street the next day. A rich crimson velvet waistcoat, with buttons of blue glass and gold, a variegated blue satin stock, over which a graceful mosaic chain hung in glittering folds, a white hat worn on one side of his long curling ringlets, redolent with the most delightful hair oil, one of those white hats which looks as if it had been just skinned, and a pair of gloves not exactly of the color of boar frace, but of boor, that has been up the chimney, with a natty cane with a gilt knob, completed the upper part at any rate, of the costume of the young fellow whom the page introduced to Mrs. Timmons. Her mama and as he had been just having a dispute about the gooseberry cream when Cavalcator arrived. His presence silenced Mrs. Gashley, and Rosa, in carrying on a conversation with him in the French language which as he had acquired perfectly in an elegant finishing establishment in Kensington Square at a great advantage over her mother, who could only pursue the dialogue with very much difficulty, eyeing one or other interlocutor with an alarmed and suspicious look, and gasping out E, whenever she thought a proper opportunity arose for the use of that affirmative. I have two little menus with me, said Cavalcader to Mrs. Gashley.
Menus, yes.
Oh, indeed? Answered the lady. Two little carts.
Oh, two carts.
Oh, oui, she said. Oming, I suppose? And she looked out of the window to see if they were there. Cavalcader smiled. He produced from a pocketbook a pink paper and a blue paper, on which he had written two bills of fare, the last two which he had composed for the lamented Hauncher, and he handed these over to Mrs. Fitzroy. The poor little woman was dreadfully puzzled with these documents, as he has them in her possession still, and began to read from the pink one as follows. Einer poor 16 persons. Poach Claire a Larigadon. Do. A la Prince de Tombuctu. Du Poissons. Salmon de Severn Rouget Scratons a la Bodicea. A la Cleopater. Du Relieves. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.